Good morning. Does anyone need the lights on? Would you favor having lights on? It feels kind of nice this way. But if you have trouble, just point at the light switch and somebody will no doubt flip it on. Whoever you are, wherever you come from, whoever you love, you are welcome here at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Kent. I'm flying solo. More or less. I'm delighted that Vanessa Vesely is doing music today. Hal is out of town doing fun musician things, and we'll be back next week. And I'll be back next week with a surprise topic that I don't yet know. And by the end of today's service, you'll understand why that is very exciting for me, to be ready for surprise. Every Sunday in a couple thousand, well, about 1,000 Unitarian Universalist congregations on this continent, people gather and bring new illumination to the planet by lighting a chalice that symbolizes, among other things, how when we join together in our good intent and purpose, we bring more light into the world. And I am happy to be part of those efforts. Start the day. On this lovely, warm, perfect morning, we've come together to share our lives, to sing, to speak, and to listen. We've come together to celebrate the fullness of our lives, our joys, and our sadness. We give thanks for being here, be we young or old, dark or light, lesbian or gay or bisexual or transgender, and straight, each seeking truth, justice, and comfort. We give thanks for being here, rich and poor, currently able and disabled. We give thanks for having a place to be together and find meaning together. We give thanks for gathering together as separate individuals, bringing the wholeness of our lives into this congregation. We give thanks for coming together as people who are more than categories. We gather, each ministering to the other, meeting each other's strengths, encouraging wholeness. Here may we grow together, stretching our minds, opening our hearts, deepening our spirits. Here may we acknowledge our wounds and discover the beginning of healing. Here may we praise this and every morning and find hope for every new day. Come, let us worship. Our young people are about to leave the room and go to Peru. It's about 3,700 miles away as the crow flies, so that better fly fast because we want you back in about an hour. And I also, I have to say, I took a trip yesterday much further than 3,700 miles. I went from Stowe to Potterfest. And I parked over here as smart people did, and I hobbled over to down in the zoo area. And it was just fabulous to see so many people there. And I just have to say, you're going to need a bigger town. Community is a lovely thing. We don't have to be alike to love alike. That's a central tenet of Unitarianism. And God is love is a central tenet of Universalism. So we have a pretty good blend to draw from. We exist now in the time and space between our birth and our death. Where on that line we cannot know, but we do know, we must know that we are not alone. God, who is our mother, father, spirit in which we live and move and breathe, the unknowable, the master formula of all, the mystery from whence we came, be with us always as we are with each other. In what appear to be our lonely moments, may we remember how close we really are to each other. When we feel the warmth of those near us right now, feel the air move in the room, note gently our awareness of others. We must be reminded that we are not alone. As we go through our days, in a world full of great injustice, where there's cruelty and violence, which causes fear in us, may we forgive and be forgiven our moments of pettiness. At time of hostility and aggression, may we forgive and be forgiven our moments of anger. May we learn to move beyond the need to forgive and be forgiven and arrive at a place of honoring and celebrating the human condition in all our complex and astonishing variety. We do this first by realizing that we are not alone. And for not arriving at that place yet, for being clumsy along the way or forgetting where we're going, may we forgive ourselves and be forgiven. Let us awaken to the beauty that surrounds us, the beauty in each other, and the beauty in ourselves. Amen. This morning's reading is from Johan Huizinga, a Dutch historian and one of the founders of modern cultural history. Huizinga had an aesthetic approach to history where art and spectacle played an important part. Homo Ludens, or Man as Player, was his famous book that he wrote in 1938. It discusses the importance of the play element in culture and society, and it starts like this. Play is older than culture, for culture, however inadequately defined, always presupposes human society, and animals have not waited for man to teach them their playing. We can safely assert even that human civilization has added no essential feature to the general idea of play. Animals play just like people. We have only to watch young dogs to see all the essentials of human play are present in their merry gambols. They invite one another to play by a certain ceremoniousness of attitude and gesture. They keep to the rule that you shall not bite, nor bite hard, your sibling's ear. They pretend to get terribly angry. And what is more important, in all these doings, they plainly experience tremendous fun and enjoyment. Such rompings of young dogs are only one of the simpler forms of animal play. Here we have at once a very important point. Even in its simplest forms, on the animal level, play is more than a mere physiological phenomenon or a psychological reflex. It goes beyond the confines of purely physical or purely biological activity. It is a significant function. That is to say, there is some sense to it. In play, there is something at play which transcends the immediate needs of life and imparts meaning to the action. All play means something. If we call the active principle that makes up the essence of play instinct, we explain nothing. If we call it mind or will, we say too much. However we may regard it, the very fact that play has a meaning implies a non-materialistic quality in the nature of the thing itself. Let us enumerate once more the characteristics we deemed proper to play. It is an activity which proceeds within certain limits of time and space, in a visible order, according to rules freely accepted, and outside the sphere of necessity or material utility. The play mood is one of rapture and enthusiasm and is sacred or festive in accordance with the occasion. Thus writes Johann Huizinga, read by our worship associate today, Reverend Anya Johnson, and I'll be back with my own words in just a moment. Now, I don't repeat sermons. I essentially never repeat sermons, but I often revisit and recast messages from the past. I think it's odd, I've been told anyway, that it's odd that I do reuse titles for different sermons, and the math doesn't work out. It's not the same title for the same sermon. It's the same title for maybe three different sermons. I think that explains something about my filing system. I knew I wanted to speak about play, so I was going through my files, and something I wrote about 8 years ago popped up in my search. That moment in time explains part of what I left in from that original text. And I am especially aware, after reading through that just from 8 years ago, which was reflecting on years before that, just how much the effect the authors I cite today have had on my way of being in the world. It's much greater than I would have imagined, but you don't think about those things. The thoughts on play and purpose have increased my ability to adapt to the changing realities of life and accept new information with the attitude that, well, this is what we have to work with now. Oh, no worship associate, this is what we have to work with now. Oh, things growing in my ankle, I need surgery. Well, this is what we have to work with now. This is the thing that's happening. The sense of play enters in to the ease in which we live. The first book I read by James P. Carse, a theologian and professor, is titled Finite and Infinite Games, A Vision of Life and Play as Possibility. It seems obvious to me that James P. Carse was very familiar with Johann Huizinga, not personally, but intellectually. Within the concept of play, he speaks of games. The entire first chapter reads, "There are at least two kinds of games. One could be called finite, the other infinite. A finite game is played for the purpose of winning. An infinite game for the purpose of continuing the play. Finite players play within boundaries. Infinite players play with boundaries." End of chapter. So go with me, if you will, back to 1968. Just generally, Martin Luther King Jr. had been shot and killed. Robert Kennedy had been shot and killed. At the tender age of 10, for whatever reason, I was paying a great deal of attention to this world that was quite confusing, and people were getting killed just for having beliefs. I became aware of Ted Kennedy just after Robert died, and the talk concerning his political plans in the wake of so much violence and destruction in his family, the assassination of his second brother in a row. In the midst of such intense and dramatic loss, the stunned and grieving Ted responded to an interview. He said, "One thing we have learned in my family is not to be too specific in our plans." He then retreated from public life briefly, spent some time in isolation before recommitting to a life of service to this country. That was 8 years ago that Ted died. It's possible that 8 years ago an era in U.S. politics died. You don't have to have liked the man to recognize his contribution and commitment to justice and equality. You don't have to ignore his mistakes and shortcomings to see the immense good that came from his life. We're each complex combinations of likable and less likable qualities. Now, Ted Kennedy had groomed himself to be in the shadow of his elders. That was the family structure. He allowed himself a great deal of play, which led perhaps to some irresponsible choices, as young people will do. But he was brought up in the same environment that created his brothers, John Fitzgerald Kennedy and Robert Kennedy. And then there was Ted, who grew up with the constant support and competition of his brothers, like young dogs playing. You may have heard that at one point his brothers threw him overboard when they were sailing out in the harbor at the age of 6 because he didn't know what a jib was. Okay, in order to think of that as play, you have to also believe that those same brothers would never have let him drown. It was brother play. It was maybe biting a little hard on your sibling's ear, but no one died from that. The thread of what made that Kennedy generation as adept as they were at leading change for the good of the many was the environment of play and gaming in which they matured. As much as they may have talked of winning, they were not talking about a finite game. They were not playing within boundaries. Consider that a finite game has a precise beginning and end and has clear spatial and numerical boundaries. There always has to be an opponent in a finite game. And that leads to winners and losers, to scorekeeping. Such a finite perspective can creep in and limit what is possible for us if we're not careful and attentive. Infinite games have no spatial, temporal, or numerical boundaries, and no winners or losers or rankings. Finite games are externally defined. We call that rules. Infinite games are internally defined. We call that vision. Within the larger infinite game, there may be any number of finite games, which are unimportant compared to the vision, the larger vision with no boundaries. Play and importance are not mutually exclusive. To be playful is not to act as if nothing of consequence will happen. When we're playful with each other, we relate as free persons. Everything that happens is then of consequence. In fact, it is being serious that closes itself to consequence. For seriousness is the dread of the unpredictable outcome of open possibility. To be serious is to press for a specified conclusion. To be playful is to allow for possibilities you may not have expected. Just after Ted Kennedy died, President Obama referred to the long string of tragedy and loss that Kennedy experienced and said this: "It is a string of events that would have broken a lesser man, and it would have been easy for Teddy to let himself become bitter and hardened. to surrender to self-pity and regret, to retreat from public life and live out his years in peaceful quiet. No one would have blamed him for that. But Ted had said, individual faults and frailties are no excuse to give in and no exemption from the common obligation to give of ourselves. That may be the political environment that died with Ted Kennedy. Individual faults and frailties are no excuse to give in and no exemption from the common obligation to give of ourselves. I miss that attitude in politics. And as caring and thoughtful people, it's hard to imagine that anyone would not be grateful for what Kennedy gave to the disenfranchised, the marginalized, and therefore by extension every American, more than any other senator in several lifetimes. Some tangible examples include Meals on Wheels, the Americans with Disabilities Act, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, civil rights, voting rights, minimum wages, mental health care, other health care. He wrote and sponsored more than any other senator. If that doesn't fill you with gratitude, it may be that you have a different way of measuring that which matters. That's secondary, however, to today. I do think back to my awareness of that time, at that time, of violence and fear in the world, as well as from what I continue to learn and witness in the decades since. And the future generally looks better than the past. Some days it's hard to remember that, but in part because of the efforts of people willing to stay in the game, smart enough to see that it's an ever-changing game, infinite, to use today's language. We have our own task here, this very local environment, this congregation, of staying engaged in designing our forms of play in ways that allow for the future to enter in. How will the Unitarian Universalist Church of Kent move through ever-changing political, social, demographic, and economic environments? How will we make room for all the Potter people? Because I'll tell you, there's no room here, and they could show up any moment. How do we remain open and embracing to the unknowns that lay in store? It's an exciting time, and I realize that I am a harbinger of change, and that change is difficult. That doesn't mean I'm difficult. Change is also certain, and I'm just a steady reminder. But as a harbinger, I bring hope as well as challenge. Surprise in infinite play is the triumph of the future over the past. Ah, yes, that's right. The triumph of the future over the past. With each surprise, the past reveals a new beginning. To be prepared against surprise is to be trained. That's caution. That's, I can't deal with surprise, so I train myself against that. I've done that in parts of my life. You probably have too. Education is being prepared for surprise. You can be trained to avoid surprise or to try. You can be educated to be ready for surprise. Education discovers an increasing richness in the past because it sees what is unfinished there. Training regards the past as finished and the future as to be finished. Training is finite, dogmatic even. Education, however, leads to continuing self-discovery. Training leads toward a final self-definition, as if we become a finished product. Training leads to repetition. Education continues this unfinished past into the future. The moment that we have passed through is still significant in our lives over and over again. And even Ted Kennedy is still significant in our lives. He may have been trained to be happy in the shadows, but he was also educated to be ready for the unknown. And when the time arrived, he stepped up and did a good thing. He said, "For all my years in public life, I believe that America must sail toward the shores of liberty and justice for all. There's no end to that journey, only the next great voyage. We know the future will outlast all of us, but I believe that all of us will live on in the future we made." I love that statement. There's no end to the journey, only the next great voyage. Yay. We know the future will outlast all of us. Do we know that? Do we know that inside, that the future will outlast us? And do we believe that we will live on in the future we made? So I wonder, what do we know about the future? For you, for our congregation, for our city, for our country, for everyone. At that time, President Obama also said, "We cannot know for certain how long we have here. We cannot foresee the trials or misfortunes that will test us along the way. We cannot know God's plan for us. What we can do is live out our lives as best we can with purpose and love and joy. We can use each day to show those who are closest to us how much we care about them and treat others with the kindness and respect that we wish for ourselves. We can learn from our mistakes and grow from our failures, and we can strive at all costs to make a better world so that someday, if we are blessed with the chance to look back on our time here, we can know that we spent it well, that we made a difference, that our fleeting presence had a lasting impact on the lives of other human beings." I do miss his oratory skills. Oh, President Obama. What we do together is far too important to play games, yet I'm asking you to be playful. What we do is much too important to think we will ever be finished. Yet I will ask you to think of milestones along the path of the surprising future. In the immediate future, as in the next few months, and as a vital piece of congregational identity, which is a key part of what we clarify during interim times, I want you to surprise yourself with what you see as possible. I believe some people did that in the interviews that have gone on for the last few weeks by the Ministerial Search Committee. And I'm asking you to extend that further and participate in a different way, a little time travel. Just imagine a time within the next 5 years, 2 years, 3 years, 10 years, you decide. Put that date on the top of a page and write a letter from that point in time back to now, back to right now. Maybe you can start with, "Remember back when," "Remember back when," and describe something wonderful that's grown here between now and that future. This is a homework assignment. And I'll be delighted if you will accept the task. Remember back when we were little and only had two services for most of the year? It's just a reminder that next week we start two services again. It's a tradition. It's time. I hope it's this weather. I hope it's this weather next week. Send me those letters, bring them to me, and we'll show how a collective vision arises out of singular thoughts. Part of the History and Future project we'll be doing this fall, we'll be spreading a timeline of this congregation across the back of this room, probably across the back, and we'll fill in some things we know from the distant past, you know, the first constitution of the First Universalist Church of Kent, 1866, May 27th, I think. Somebody here probably knows that, so I shouldn't make stuff up, but I think it was May 27th, 1866. In fact, I would bet a cup of coffee on that. I don't do much betting. But that'll be way back on this side. And now will be not to the end. Because what you imagine of the future goes beyond now. And what you imagine and write and share becomes part of that vision. Not a rule, not a law, not a dogma. An unlimited, infinite vision made up of the people who comprise this congregation. Who comprise. What we do here is simple. Life and death and love. That's how important it is and how simple it is. Now, I suspect when you think of this moment and the future, you'll be interested in openness and growth individually and collectively. I suspect you will envision that there is always room for one more, that no visitor is ever ignored at this church. I hope that you will picture a future in which each person is held lovingly accountable, a future when people reach out to each other openly, when the needs of the many are at the forefront. I envision a church that is a success, and I imagine you will too. Whether this is your first time here or whether you've been here for many, many years, your picture of the future is important. I'm really eager to read anything you will write about that. You may want to keep in mind another passage, partly from Bobby Kennedy, partly from Teddy, and slightly modified. Our future may lie beyond our vision, but it is not completely beyond our control. It is the shaping impulse of America that neither fate nor nature nor the irresistible tides of history, but the work of our own hands, matched to reason and principle, that will determine our destiny. There is pride in that, even arrogance, but there is also experience and truth. In any event, it is the only way we can live. That's the way they live. That's what they leave us. And that's how we can live. The Kennedys don't need to be idealized or enlarged in death beyond what they were in life. Just remembered simply as people doing the best they could. Just like you and me. People who saw wrong and tried to right it. Saw suffering, tried to heal it. Saw war, and tried to stop it. Those of us who mourn the end of that generation pray that what they wished for us and others will someday come to pass for all the world. As Bobby said many times in many parts of this nation, to those he touched and who sought to touch him, some men see things as they are and say, why? I dream things that never were and say, why not? You can do that right here, right now. And you can be the church this community needs for the future. Join together. Remember, you're never alone. May it be so. As we prepare, let me share with you that today's special collection benefits SPAN Ohio. The mission of the Single Payer Action Network of Ohio is to educate citizens and legislators on the need to advocate for fundamental change in our healthcare system. You can read more about it in the order of service. Please give generously. It is a part of the identity of this congregation to reach beyond these walls and support causes that help the future. Thank you. I understand that the typewriter is not Brad's first instrument, but I've never heard it played better. What a great choice. Please reach out to those near you and hold hands if you're willing to. I always remember that it's always cold and flu season somewhere. So as a public health service, I remind you to wash your hands often and don't stick them in your mouth. It's the best way to be healthy in community is to have clear boundaries of behavior and sanitation. There are two main principles under which we operate. Our Unitarian past said God is one. There's only one. It's all-encompassing God. Our Universalist past says God is love and everybody gets it. Whatever salvation is, everybody gets it. God is love. God is one. Our task, be as one, be as love. Think of that this week as you please write a letter from the future back to where we are now. Look in the mirror at least once this week and say, hello, beautiful. Aren't you something? Maybe that doesn't happen enough for some of us. So do it for yourself. Believe it. This God says it. This God says it. We say it together. Go in peace and return in love.